I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
In a public speech at Alexandria tonight, President Nasser announced that Egypt would build the Aswan Dam from her own resources. Funds would be obtained from Operation of Suez Canal. Law nationalizing Suez Canal and expropriating Canal Company was approved by Cabinet this morning. Text, as read out by Nasser, follows. Police have just been posted round Canal Company's Cairo office. British Ambassador to Egypt, Humphrey Trevelyan, reports on Nasser's provocative nationalization of the Suez Canal Company. Telegram received in London at 9:45 p.m., 26th of July, 1956. I expect that most of us have seen, sometimes with amusement and sometimes with anger, reports and orders obviously worded with an eye to the future historian, or, as we used to call them, for the record. The wording of signals and orders for the record is a very fine art and well calculated to fox the historian. Lord Tedder, writing in his book With Prejudice, 1966. In England, in the late 1950s and early 60s, the word was a political taunt of considerable force and pungency. One had only to shout, Suez, at a Conservative orator to see his features decompose with dismay. A classic Tory education, Eton, Munich and Suez, was how one scornful writer sketched the political career of a former Prime Minister. Like Munich, indeed, Suez had become an indelible metaphor for fiasco, dishonour, and humiliation. Christopher Hitchens, writing in 1986.
Come to the station, jump from the train, march at the double down Lover's Lane, then in the glen where the roses entwine.
Hello and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to 1956, part 2, The Suez Crisis. I hope you are ready for this, history friend, because I really love this story, and when I released it a few years ago, it was really well received, and you guys really got into it. So, second time around, I think the results are going to be even better. We follow on from what we covered in our examination of the Soviet Union after Stalin's death, and that story, the previous section of this series, actually molds together quite well with what we're about to look at here. So, without any further ado, let's just get into it. As I take you, not to 1956, but to 1938. Trust me, this'll all make sense. And it helps set the scene for the next few months, where we'll be delving very deeply indeed into Britain's seminal disaster of the post-war era. On Sunday, the 20th of February 1938, Anthony Eden resigned as British Foreign Secretary. It had been a difficult last few months. The troubling international situation was coupled with Eden's differences with his colleagues. Appeasement, Eden believed, was not working as a policy. Not so, believed Neville Chamberlain. That autumn, Chamberlain would acquire peace in our time, while Eden drew closer to his friend and ally in the Conservative camp, Winston Churchill. On the day Churchill was made Prime Minister, the 10th of May 1940, Eden was present. Almost exactly 15 years to that date later, in March 1955, Anthony Eden took the reins from Churchill and assumed the premiership. It was a position which many people and politicians believed had been a long time coming at the time. One individual, later a historian and politician, wrote on Eden in the 1970s that Anthony was the golden boy, slim, handsome and charming. My generation looked upon him as typifying the generation who had survived the war to become the champion and defender of our pathetic beliefs in what proved to be those ephemeral Wilsonian shibboleths of a war to end wars and let us make the world safe for democracy. Though he did not succeed, we knew it was no fault of his, and he retained our confidence. This confidence was twinned with an expectation of great success. Anthony, the arch anti-appeaser, the man of integrity, the honourable leader, would lead the Conservative Party now at a time of uncertainty, as the Cold War was intensifying, but as conflict seemed, nonetheless, distant. In actual fact, Eden was to shatter these assumptions about his character, and he was to do so in such a way and on such a stage as to shatter Britain's reputation in a post-war world. For a variety of reasons, some ideological, some practical, and some personal, Anthony Eden made this Suez crisis possible. It was Eden who developed a seething hatred of all things President Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt. It was Eden who obsessed over losing the Suez Canal or losing any advantage to a former colonial vassal. It was Eden who gave his blessing to collusion with France and Israel, thereby catapulting British foreign policy into a crisis it had not known the likes of since 1940. It was Eden who, after approving a policy which was designed to trick the world and bring Britain the triumph he felt she needed, proceeded to lie his head off about every single aspect of it. It was Eden who tampered with evidence, attempted to destroy evidence, and ignored the sound counsel of men who knew better. The Suez Crisis, quite simply, is a story we cannot tell without also telling the story of Anthony Eden. It is for this reason above all that our examination of this crisis will be rooted firmly in the perspective of the British. This gives us a sound position from which to examine the rest of the events that took place over October and November 1956, but it also ensures that we do not miss the key ingredients which Anthony Eden, Britain's Prime Minister from March 1955 to January 1957, brought to them. Without Eden, there would have been no crisis, of that I'm quite certain, after having written 21 episodes, trawled through the source material, the articles and extensive records on the House of Commons debates. If the Suez Crisis is a story you've never heard before, then my approach will not strike you as particularly innovative. To those that know the Suez Crisis, indeed, the person of Eden remains central to understanding why matters proceeded as they did. Yet at the same time, we would be remiss if we failed to look at the desperate French government, which was fast losing ground in Algeria and which saw disaster and pressures everywhere. We would also be remiss if we neglected to mention Israel, barely 10 years old by the time the Suez Crisis erupted. The threats Israel faced compelled its government to seek allies, and they found them, and plentiful arms deals, in the French. To both Paris and Tel Aviv, Egypt appeared to be the primary concern. It was Egypt's Colonel Nasser who had consistently threatened Israel with destruction. It was Nasser who advocated a pan-Arabism solution to the tangled Middle East as a way of deliberately excluding Israel from making friends. It was Nasser who stuck his nose into any conflict with a colonial bent to it, such as the one taking place in Algeria between the French government and Algerian rebels. Nasser was brutal, he was ambitious, he was effective, he was strong, and he was popular. Then, in July 1956, Nasser took the greatest leap of all and forcibly nationalised the Suez Canal Company. But what was this company? Well, the Suez Canal Company was the multinational corporation charged with controlling, policing, and maintaining the critical Suez waterway. As an accessible international thoroughway of commerce and shipping, this Suez Company was relatively new, but as an idea, the Suez Canal was ancient. Many civilizations had attempted to transform the short portion of land between the Mediterranean and Red Sea into an artificial passageway. Along this artery, travel, trade, and defense became profoundly cheaper, better, and more active. It would remove the need to travel all the way around Africa in order to reach the prosperous Far East. By 1869, with French ingenuity and money, this ancient dream was made a reality, but it quickly turned into a nightmare for those that attempted to make the dream work. The canal had not taken off as hoped. It remained too narrow and in need of constant repair and policing. The native Egyptian ruler had bankrupted himself in his efforts to support its construction, and with his debtors chasing him down, he sold his shares in the Suez Canal Company. This 40% stake was valuable indeed. It would give the purchaser a sizable stake in the company charged with administering the canal and receiving its profits. It was to the Egyptian Khedive's immense surprise, then, that the previously disinterested British appeared on the scene, ready to purchase his stake with interest. Benjamin Disraeli, thanks to the help of his Rothschild friends, raised a gargantuan sum, and with an impressed Queen Victoria looking on, Britain acquired a major stake in this brave new technological and engineering marvel. There was much to be done, but here in 1875, a love affair of immense proportions was incepted. Within the next decade, as the major shareholder, Britain had transformed Egypt into its protectorate, and the canal was recast from a French misadventure into the key to the imperial jewel of India. To lose Suez was to lose India, was to lose the empire. Through two world wars, the Suez Canal stood firm, its old 19th century company still holding out against the kind of nationalizations seen in other states. Egypt, thanks to British meddling, was ruled by the docile King Farouk, and this king wasn't about to jeopardize the good thing he had going by threatening the British interest of the canal company. According to the terms of an 1888 convention on the canal, King Farouk would have been within his rights to have nationalized the canal company, but he would never dream of such an act. The British kept him in a state of perpetual luxury, and he remained very far indeed from his beleaguered Egyptian subjects. So long as this relationship continued, a bribed King Farouk could be expected to keep well away from the canal and permit the lucrative British investments in the canal to be returned with interest. Interestingly, the loss of India in the late 1940s didn't diminish the importance of the canal either. Indeed, it seemed to reinforce its importance, because without the canal, it seemed possible that the remainder of the empire and the Commonwealth itself would also crumble, unsupported and unsupplied, into the abyss. Then, in July 1952, King Farouk was ousted in a coup led by the Egyptian army. Foremost in this coup was the dashing young colonel Gamal Abdel Nasser. Perhaps not since Gandhi had a figure in Britain's imperial sphere so challenged and confounded British sensibilities. Here was a man who knew Egypt's importance to Britain and who understood the advantages his country possessed in the grand scheme of world interest. He couldn't be bribed, at least not by Britain, and he could not be persuaded to take any course other than that of resistance and the pursuit of national or pan-Arab interests. Just as this dynamic new leader was accumulating power in Egypt, Sir Anthony was finally getting his chance to come into his own in Britain. It cannot be a coincidence that the Suez Crisis loomed only 18 months after Anthony Eden came to power. For this reason alone, Eden's career deserves analysis in the context of the crisis, and this is a task we will absolutely tackle. Important as it is to examine Eden, we'll also examine how British political debate at home proceeded over October and November, and we'll take our cue from the debates taking place in the House of Commons as we build a picture of how British statesmen at home, and the British people too, reacted to what was happening abroad. This perspective grants us the opportunity to see Eden and his government as the opposition would have seen them. If Eden comes off badly overall, then it is this focus on the domestic that really puts the nail in his career. But of course, this is when diplomacy fails, and domestic politics, while important for placing us in context, is not what we're all about here. The British relationship with France and how a new entente was developed into the Sèvres Protocol requires examination. as does Britain's relationship with the Commonwealth states and how each state pursued its own policy and held its own interests close at heart. In a time where loyalty to the mother country still counted for something, examining these trends has been fascinating. Another line of inquiry was Britain's relationship with the United Nations and how British delegates managed to frustrate that organisation's genuine efforts to make peace. This made the Brits unpopular with the Americans and the Eisenhower administration, whose leader was on the verge of another election victory at the time, and this will be the lens through which we view American foreign policy, controlled by the eminently capable Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles. British intransigence and deception made its representatives few friends in the United Nations or Washington, but surprisingly, the European states, which had moved closer to it in the last few years, did support Eden's quest, as we'll see. Startled by Soviet aggression in Hungary, the European states closed ranks just at the time when Britain needed their support most. This relationship between Britain and the Western European Union and the Western European Union's relationship with both the United States and United Nations are aspects of the Suez story which also need to be told. And then there were the Soviets. The Soviet angle in the crisis and the role which Soviet foreign policymakers played in empowering Egypt at Britain's expense has to be looked at. The striking thing about 1956 was the fact that crises like Suez and Hungary occurred so close together, preventing the West from formulating any unified response to either. The implications of this for the West and whether Britain could be blamed for the lack of a Western rescue package for Hungary will also be considered. As far as sources go, I should point you guys to the bibliography. Within this series, we use a great deal of primary sources, thanks in large part to the trove of such material being available online. Be it in Hansard's digitised collection of parliamentary debates, or the partnership between Yale and the United Nations to record interviews held with some of the people who served their countries during this crisis. This gives me the opportunity to engage with material on a scale I rarely get to do in this podcast, and this is, of course, very exciting. Something which makes this project all the more interesting is the fact that it was only within the last 30 years that these materials became available. Incredible though it sounds, before 1986 there was officially a blanket ban on the release of sources to the public. As to what really went down in Suez, well, this remained a state secret, literally. And then in 1987 you had the opening of the historiographical floodgates, so to speak, which led to an explosion in accounts of the Suez crisis. But as we'll see, even before this material was released, individuals who had served in the crisis and historians who attempted to read between the lines all released their own accounts of what had happened, with fascinating degrees of accuracy and truth therein. This series would not have been possible without the work of the historians, and as ever, I'm standing very much on the shoulders of these giants, so a huge thanks to them and their hard work. And that's it, history friends. The first proper episode of the Suez Crisis is out alongside this one, so make sure you check it out. I don't want to waste any more of your time, but I should give you a huge thanks as well for listening. I am aware of the fact that not everyone appreciated that Suez and the post-de-Stalinization period made a comeback, and I think, judging by the downloads, some of you would have rather had a brand new series, but I hope you'll indulge me until we can get this podcast back on track and until my previous overworking habits manage to return and in a much more healthier way I'm able to make the content you guys want. But this content takes work, and if you would like to support this work, you know where to go. It's Patreon, and I barely have to tell you because you've been so great supporting me before, but that PhD thesis series is ongoing, and the response to that's been really good. So if you are looking for some additional content on top of all this 1956 stuff, you know where to go. But I digress. Thanks so much for listening. My name is, well, let's go full-blown Dr. Zach, shall we? The PhD, just like this show, was thanks to you. So thanks again for listening, and I'll be seeing you all soon.
Surrender to mine. Lay down your arms and surrender. even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.